Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I'm Matthew Gage. This is lesson number 17 in our series on the book of Acts. We will be in Acts chapter 12, verses 1 through 23. And the title of today's lesson is Herod and Peter. Now, most of the time when I record these lessons, I do it in one take. I do very little editing. In fact, practically no editing. The only thing that even approaches editing that I usually do, and it's probably obvious I don't do much editing, but about the only thing that I do is if I get hung up, if I want to look something up, if I really feel like I really misspoke, I will pause, go back. I mean, as I'm doing it, I'll just pause it, look something up, or I may scoot back a little bit and re-record a portion, but it's usually pretty rare. Most of these lessons I actually do record at one time. And usually I do not stop the recording. And if I do, it's two or three times. And it's because a detail eludes me or perhaps I just really get tongue-tied. But it's pretty rare. For the most part, I do these all in one sitting. And part of that is because I want to keep them very natural. I don't want them to sound very professional or produced. I want it to sound very real, just like I'm doing a Sunday school class. I want to keep it very straightforward and very understandable and very real, very intimate. So that's a lot of the reason I don't really put a lot of emphasis. I don't write this stuff out. I'm going off the same notes I used to teach my Sunday school class. I try to keep it, you know, pretty simple, pretty personal. Well, This is probably going to be the best recording, I hope. I hate to say that because it probably won't be. It'll probably be a disaster, but this ought to be the best one because this is going to be, I think, at least the third or fourth attempt at recording this. I recorded lesson number 16, earlier this week. It was Monday or Tuesday. I honestly don't remember at the moment. It was Monday. And here in Texas, it's, you know, it's end of November. It's now in December, but it's the end of November. And we had some high winds. And after I recorded lesson number 16 and got it all done, started lesson 17, our electricity went out just for a few seconds. Of course, the computer goes dead and I lose everything I'd recorded for lesson number 17. So, okay, well, I tried to record again. Electricity goes off again. And finally, I kind of gave up on it, but finally, electricity finally got to where it was staying on. I mean, it was going off and on about every 10, 15 minutes. It would flash off for a second or two. And finally, it was staying on, and I thought, well, I'm going to beat the system now. I know what to expect. I know what's going on. So I started recording again, and this was much later in the evening. I recorded some of the stuff about 7 o'clock. I mean, this is 2 or 3 hours later. And I would record for about 10 minutes. I would stop it. The thing is, I forgot to hit save. And I was assuming that GarageBand would automatically save because a lot of the software on the Mac, I just automatically save stuff. And I really hadn't played around in that particular aspect in GarageBand to see if it automatically saves or not. So I would record 7, 8, 10 minutes, get to a good stopping spot. I would stop the recording and then I'd take back off because, hey, all this is being done. It's being recorded straight to the hard drive anyway. Unfortunately, as I was wrapping up about 40 minutes of recording, the electricity went off again. I was honestly about 2 minutes from wrapping up the lesson. And I thought, well, no big deal. All I have to do is record about the last 10 minutes. Well, when I booted back up the computer, much to my dismay, I found out GarageBand does not automatically save your recordings when you stop it. So I lost everything I had recorded again. So there are portions of this lesson I think I have recorded 4 times and lost. And now the end of it, I really only got to the end of the lesson once and lost it. But I have recorded, this will be the third time I will have said and recorded most of this stuff. So hopefully it comes out a whole lot smoother. I hope it does. And some of the joys of working with computers and being at the very end of the electrical system, where if something goes out, you know, your electricity goes out because you're just furthest down the line. So with that, I just wanted to bring that to you so you can have a little sympathy for me and understand. And and hopefully it comes out a lot better, because it ought to be fresh. And I say a lot of this stuff I've already spoken 3 or 4 times, so maybe it'll come out a lot smoother. So here we go. Let's jump right in. In today's lesson, we will be dealing with a very famous story. In fact, I'm sure if you've grown up in Sunday school, you're very familiar with this. It's a great one for kids. It's a great one, you know, for children's church. It's one we often hear even in sermons. It seems like I hear a sermon on this out of this story probably about once a year, or at least hear it referenced. I hear it referenced more times than that, because it's such a great story to illustrate the power of prayer. But we're going to deal a lot deeper with it in that, and I'm sure I'll get off and chase a rabbit trail when we get to that point. But the lesson is today going to be about Peter's imprisonment and miraculous release from prison. And I say, if you've grown up in Sunday school, you probably are very familiar with the story, how Peter is thrown in jail and an angel awakes him, and they walk right out of the prison. They go to where a group of Christians are meeting. Peter knocks on the door. The poor girl that opens the door, or is answering the door, doesn't open it. She's so excited, she runs in to tell everybody that's having the prayer meeting for the release of Peter. When she runs in to tell them that Peter's at the gate, and you know they don't believe her. So finally, they go out there, and Peter's there banging on the door, and they let him in, and everybody's happy, and a happy ending to the story. So there we go, 7 minutes in, and 5 of that was me rambling about electrical problems. But there we go. There's a lesson. We're gonna dig in quite a bit deeper than that. So. As I say, it's a very familiar story, so hopefully I can bring out some interesting things, a little bit of new light onto it, especially there's a little bit of historical stuff I want to try to bring out. So this lesson takes place somewhere around the year 44 AD. Now, this one we can be pretty close on. I've spoken before about some of the dates I've used. It's pretty arbitrary. I mean, one man's opinion is as good as another, because it is just an educated guess. This one we actually do have a pretty firm date on, because at least for the end of this lesson, because at the end of this lesson, the King Herod is going to die, and we actually have a pretty good date for that, and that actually took place in 44 AD. In comparing writings of this and Josephus, we're pretty certain that that is the date. So this is one of the rare times where it's just not an arbitrary date. It looks like most of this happened in 43, 44 AD, somewhere in that time period. It just, if you want to say it all happened in the same year, hey, that's fine. But the very end of this lesson, we're almost assuredly takes place in 44 AD. Now, the first part of our lesson will take place in Jerusalem, and of course, Jerusalem we're very familiar with, kind of the capital of Judea, you know, the capital since the days of David, very important city, the temple's there, there's a large population, so we're very familiar with Jerusalem and everything that's happened there. The last part of our lesson, the last few verses, take place at Caesarea, which is the port city built by King Herod. It is the Roman capital, kind of the province of Judea. So that's where the seat of government is. As far as Rome is concerned, they actually except for on big days when they really need to have a presence, they would go down to Jerusalem. But for the most part, the Roman rulers did not have a big presence in Jerusalem. It's just too dangerous. And so they stayed up in Caesarea. And the last thing we'll deal with is in setting up this lesson is, who is Herod? Here we go, another Herod in our story. Okay, one thing in the Bible is the Christian writers, the Jewish writers of the New Testament, name a lot of people Herod, and they're all of the same family, but they're not the same person. So the Herodian family starts with King Herod, who we know as Herod the Great, and he reigned. He actually died in about the year 4 BC, and most Bible scholars believe that he is the Herod of the nativity story, that he is the King Herod that ordered the slaughter of the innocents and that met with the wise men. There's some people that hold a little bit different theory that maybe it was his son, but I don't know. It's not really likely. So, but most people traditionally believe that, that Herod the Great, was the Herod of the nativity story. Now, the Herod that we're dealing with today, and so there's other Herods, even in the New Testament, there's a Herod Antipas, there's quite a bit. The Herod we're dealing with today is the grandson of Herod the Great. Now, Herod the Great, let's deal with this. Herod the Great was not a Jew by blood. His father or his grandfather, I always get confused on that, they was forcibly converted to Judaism when the Jews, after the Maccabean Revolt, were starting to reconquer the region and set up this independent Jewish state. They conquered, and basically they would tell the people, well, you either convert to Judaism or you die. And a lot of people chose to become Jews. And that's what happened in Herod's family. Herod the Great's father actually was like a governor of the region. But by blood, they were Edomites. They were, a lot of people classify them as Arabian, but they were probably like a Palestinian type people. Okay. They were Canaanite people. So he is not a Jew by blood. Now, by practice, at least nominally or in public, these people, his family were Jews. In fact, one of his wives was Bernice, or Bernice. Bernice is probably the more proper way to pronounce it. Was actually a granddaughter and daughter of some of the Maccabean leaders that set up the Hasmonean dynasty. So he actually kind of married into that family. So, you know, it just depends on how you look at these rulers. The Jews, for the most part, accepted them as Jews, but at the same time, they had very Greek/Roman ways. When Herod the Great built, for instance, we already talked about the Caesarea, when he built that, it is a very Greek-style city with an amphitheater and very Greek-style buildings. It does not look like a Judean city. It is very much in the style of the Greeks and the Romans. So they could kind of choose which way they want to be. Master politicians, they could run in these different circles and be at home. And the Herod that we're going to talk about today was very much the same way. He is Herod Agrippa the First. He is grandson of Herod the Great, actually of Herod and Bernice. And he reigned from 37 to 44 AD. Excuse me. Now, Herod Agrippa was raised, actually from about the age of 6, I believe it was, in Rome itself. He was friends with the emperors Claudius and Caligula. So he had a lot of connections at Rome. He could be as Roman as a Roman. He could be as Greek as a Greek. He could be as Jewish as a Jew. And as I say, just I picture him as a master politician and just able to fit right into whatever group. Because of this multicultural background, he could fit in with all of them. And he ends up with some of the turmoil that takes place in Judea and the death of some of the other rulers. He ends up being appointed basically because of his connections as a king, a client king of Rome, and ruling over Judea. And by most accounts, in Josephus, it seems like he was popular, that people liked him, that he was not a terrible king, and that because he could at least put on a front of being Jewish, that a lot of the Jews really accepted him. So he was a fairly popular king. Now I'll go ahead and point out, though, he doesn't have very long reign, not a very long life, but his son is also going to come into play. Herod Agrippa II is the Agrippa that Paul will be dealing with a little later on in our story. So it's the same family line. He probably was not called Herod as a name. It appears that, you know, he went by Agrippa by most of the sources and stuff, and that leads some people to criticize the Bible. They think, well, it says he's Herod, but he really wasn't. And it seems to be a generalization that because he was of the family, they just kept the name or were called by the name, throwing back to, Herod the Great, and kind of keeping that dynasty alive. So I don't see a big deal with that. Some of the stuff I actually was just reading before I started recording kind of said that, and I don't see that as an issue. That when he was writing this, instead of writing Agrippa, which is a very, very popular Roman name, that he actually, Luke just uses the name Herod because everybody would recognize that as a ruler of Judea. And if he wrote Agrippa, they would think, well, which Agrippa? You know, there's plenty of Agrippas around here. So I do not see an issue at all with that. So that's just my humble amateur historian opinion. So with that, we've kind of set up who he is. Let's jump right on into our lesson. So as I think when I'm dealing with this, I'm probably going to fly through a bunch of it because it is such a very familiar story. And I'll probably slip into children's church mode and, go to telling the story like I would to a bunch of kids. So just excuse me if I do that. So here we are, Acts chapter 12. Let's begin in verse 1. Now, about that time, Herod the king, which, as I said, that's Herod Agrippa I, stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church, and he killed James, the brother of John, with the sword. So why did he do this? It's answered in verse 3. And because he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter. Then were the days of unleavened bread. So here we go. We have Herod Agrippa. This decides to probably a very political move. Maybe it was a move to help stabilize things. But he decides to go after the church and persecute the church. According to Schofield notes, this is the fifth persecution that's taken place. And in doing so, he didn't just round up, just the common folk. He actually goes after the leadership. And they captured James, who is the brother of John. This is one of the sons of Zebedee, one of the apostles, and has him killed. Now, it's very interesting. It talks about him killed by the sword. He was not stoned. This was not like with Stephen. This he wasn't crucified. Killed with the sword basically means he was just executed. They just did away with him. Just kind of in an inglorious fashion, took him in the back room and chopped his head off. That's basically the idea that I take from that. And, of course, that proves very popular, this persecution, the fact that he took out one of the leaders. Of course, we know, remember, James and John were nicknamed the Sons of Thunder, so it's very likely James is out there and being very vocal and out front in leadership. And so taking out one of the head people who's in the limelight so much and is such a vocal proponent of the church, it proves very popular with the Jewish people. So he says, well, his advisors, I can just picture his advisors gather around, say, wow, your poll numbers have gone up quite a bit here. we ought to keep doing this a little more. What do you say we kill another one of these Christians? And it's like, well, great. Well, let's get Peter. So in verse 3, they decide to take Peter. It's in the days of unleavened bread. That is the feast of Passover. So verse 4, and when they had apprehended him, he put him in prison and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, and intended after Easter to bring him forth to the people. Boy, I'll tell you what, I can tell I've done this three or four times because that's the best I've ever pronounced, quaternion. So, but anyway, so they capture Peter. And actually, well, I'll tell you what, I've read this really great comment on this as I was doing a little bit more study before I started recording this time. That the Feast of Passover was a feast celebrating the deliverance of Israel out of Egypt. It was celebrating their freedom. And in the midst of this celebration of freedom, Peter is in prison. You know, think about the kind of the irony, I guess, in that. That while so many millions, hundreds of thousands of people around about Jerusalem are celebrating the fact that Israel was delivered out of Egypt, here is Peter in chains in prison. They put him in prison. I tried to look up. I don't know where that prison is. It's not specific. I personally have a feeling that this was part of the Fortress Antonia, which was kind of the Roman garrison located directly right there beside the temple. Because this appears to be a political prisoner. He probably was not thrown into a Jewish prison. They didn't want anything to happen to him. This was Roman authority taking care of him. So that's just my opinion. The four quaternions of soldiers, the quaternion is a group of four, kind of, I guess you could say it's something similar to a squad of soldiers. So here we go, four times four. We have 16 soldiers who are given the order, the command to make sure Peter does not get away. And one other note on verse 4, I know, well, I'm already 20 minutes into this, but one other note on verse 4, it says, intending after Easter to deal with Peter. There are a lot of people out there who really criticize that one word in this verse, Easter. Now, I have no problem with it being there, and I think when you study it out, it makes a lot of sense because, okay, let's explain this. Passover was the Jewish holiday. Easter was a pagan holiday. It had not been Christianized. It would not happen for two or three centuries later. But it takes place about the same time of the year. And Easter is a celebration of spring, of fertility. Let's just leave it at that. So that's why we, you know, there's still rabbits involved in the imagery of it today. So it's a pagan holiday. We're dealing with pagan troops. We are dealing with a king who has a pagan background also, in spite of the little bit of Jewish blood in his veins, and in spite of, you know, being able to put on a good front, he himself very likely did celebrate Easter to some extent. It's very popular. These celebrations of spring were extremely popular with the ancient people. So it's very likely he was taking part in some of these celebrations also. So I have no problem with that word being there. It's the same time frame. What's the big deal with that? I don't understand. It's just some people want to try to make it seem match up with verse 3 where it talks about days of unleavened bread. And well, once those days are over, he'll deal with it. But from what I understand, the manuscripts, the New Testament manuscripts we have, the older ones support this word. This isn't just the King James translators making something up or are messing up the translation. It actually fits very well. And there's been some very good work done defending that word being included. All right, so now that I've got that settled, maybe, kind of, sort of, let's move on. So verse number 5. Peter, therefore, was kept in prison, but prayer was made without ceasing of the church of unto God for him. So here's the situation. In the middle of the Passover, we have Peter in prison. He's chained up. And in fact, it'll talks about it here in the next verse, but he's chained up. Seems like there's no hope, but the church itself is having prayer meetings. They are making supplication unto God on Peter's behalf to have Peter released. And I can sense the urgency because, hey, look what just happened to James. They're afraid this is going to happen to Peter. So they are praying, and they are praying hard. Verse 6, and when Herod would have brought him forth, the same night Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and the keepers before the door kept the prison. So the orders come down that in the morning Peter is going to be executed. And so the setting is the night before, we have Peter, he is chained. I mean, picture, you know, handcuffs or something there, but he is shackled with two chains to two soldiers. You know, they're making sure this guy ain't going anywhere. Now, I wonder if some of this has to do, you know, Peter and John, I believe it was, got out of prison before. So, you know, I don't think they want to take any chance. And, you know, it talks about keepers before the door. So there's guards outside the cell. There's guards crawling. They don't want anything happen to this guy. I'm sure, you know, somewhere that night there's an executioner preparing, you know, making sure his sword is sharp, that they're going to kill a Jew. And from what I understand about the Roman garrison at that time, it's a lot of Syrian people or non-Jewish people from the region. So they were Gentile people from around Judea. And they did not like the Jews. They hated the Jews. There's a bunch of records of stuff that they did mocking the Jews. So anyway, I'm thinking one right now that's a little PG rated. I don't want to talk about, but I don't want to bring up in this, but it is funny. But anyway, there's records of them doing things to mock the Jews. And you know, killing a Jew would probably bring them a lot of pleasure. I'm sure they're excited about this. So it's the middle of the night. People are asleep, which is amazing. How is Peter sleeping? This means he must be at peace with what's going to happen, or he's exhausted. He's asleep. Now, were the Roman soldiers asleep? Probably not, because sleeping on duty was something punishable by death in the Roman army. So I think that they are fully awake and alert when this begins. Not as it happens, but as it begins. So verse 7, and behold, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shined in the prison, and he smote Peter on the side and raised him up, saying, arise up quickly, and his chains fell off from his hands. So what I picture happening, the angel appears, there's a bright light. Does that sound familiar? It sounds very similar to what happened when with the resurrection of Christ. The angels appeared, the soldiers passed out. I think that's what happened. The angel appears, the soldiers pass out, and, you know, then the angel wakes up Peter, slaps him on the side, pokes him in the side, says, hey, get up, big boy. And so Peter gets up, and as he gets up, the chains just slide off of him. The locks come undone or something. A miracle takes place. He just gets up, the chains just slide off. They just fall off of him. And verse 8, and the angel said to him, gird thyself and bind on thy sandals. And so he did. And he saith unto him, cast thy garment about thee and follow me. So the angel says, get ready, get your shoes on, you know, pull up your pants, put your jacket on. We're going. That's, you know, get ready. A lot of detail given in that. Put on your shoes, you know, gird thyself, you know, it's kind of, you know, get ready to go. Cast thy garment, that's his coat. So like, hey, get ready, let's go. Excuse me. Let's see, verse 9. And he went out and followed him. That's Peter went out and followed the angel, and wist not that it was true, which was done by the angel, but thought he saw a vision. So Peter is evidently not a morning person, and being awoke out of sleep, he not really sure what's going on. I mean, he hadn't had his morning coffee or anything, and I can relate to this. I'm kind of that way in the morning. I'm not a coffee drinker. I probably could be, but you know, I can kind of relate to poor Peter here. He's stumbling around, you know, this angel's got him by the hand, dragging him through the prison. He's wondering, what in the world's going on? Am I dreaming this? This can't be really happening. And so verse 10, when they were past the first and second ward, so this is them going out of the innermost part of the prison and working their way out. They came unto the iron gate that leadeth unto the sea. So there's an iron gate. This is a solid gate. This isn't wooden. You know, it couldn't be burned down. This is solid. This is as solid as it gets, as impenetrable as it gets in ancient times. Which opened to them of his own accord. So the gate just opens. And they went out and passed on through one street, and forthwith the angel departed from him. So they just walk right out of the prison and say, what happened? Were there no guards? Were the guards sleeping? Absolutely not. This is a miracle that takes place. Now, God, you know, the science fiction part of my mind thinks, well, God stopped time. And, you know, they just walked right out. And, you know, no, I honestly think that the guards just passed out. I think that the angel put them to sleep, just like what happened with at the resurrection of Christ. So let's see. So they get out and they're going down the street and the angel disappears. Verse 11, and when Peter was come to himself, so he finally wakes up, he said, now I know of a surety that the Lord hath sent his angel and hath delivered me out of the hand of Herod and from all the expectation of the people of the Jews. So it finally clicks. He wakes up enough to realize what's going on. It clicks in his mind and says, hey, God got me out of prison. Boy, you know, Herod's not going to kill me. The Jews are going to be disappointed. So he's got to do something. So verse 12, and when he had considered the thing, he's thinking, okay, now I'm a fugitive. You know, I've been busted out of jail. I need to get somewhere out of the middle of the street. Continuing verse 12, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark. That's John Mark. We'll talk quite a bit about him later on. Now tradition says that Mary was quite wealthy, probably a widow, but that they had a fairly large estate. They were fairly prominent in the circles there in Jerusalem. So and also had a love for the church and was a house with that the early church met in, or at least groups of the other church met in. All right, and it says here, where many were gathered together praying. So this is where one of these prayer meetings was taking place for the release of Peter. So there is a group of Christians inside praying, which is going to set up this very honestly comedic episode that's going to happen. I think this is so funny. It's something, honestly, this same little idea pops up in comedies even today, of, you know, this little mix up that's going to take place. So verse 13, as Peter knocked at the door of the gate, a damsel came to hearken named Rhoda. So Peter approaches, he knocks on the gate, which is probably like a courtyard gate. This isn't like knocking on the front door. This is probably like a kind of knocking. Imagine, if you will, a house with a fenced off yard, but instead of it being a chain link or a privacy fence, it's a brick fence that is 6-8 feet tall. And there is a gate built into that, kind of like a lot of the old Spanish architecture is kind of similar to that. That's the way this probably was kind of built. So you can imagine, he's not necessarily knocking on the front door, but he's knocking on this gate to get into this courtyard. And he knocks on the door. Everybody's inside busy. They send out the servant girl hears and goes to answer the door, which probably they're thinking, okay, hey, look, somebody else is there to pray. Hey, Rhoda, go answer the door. Now, it is kind of interesting from what I've read. I believe this is something a young man should have done. So why is this young lady doing it? I don't necessarily understand what the implication of that is, but may not be one, but it's just kind of a little thing of interest there. But this servant girl, Rhoda, goes to the gate to open it up, let Peter in. And verse 14, and when she knew Peter's voice, she opened not the gate for gladness, but ran in and told how Peter stood before the gate. So she gets there. She hears Peter say, hey, let me in. Let me in. I'm out of jail. They're going to get me. Let me in. And so she gets so excited. Wow, Peter's outside. God answered our prayer. Woohoo. She's excited. She's jumping around. So she, instead of opening the gate and letting me in, she runs back into the prayer meeting. So let's see here. Verse 15. And they said to her, thou art mad. But she constantly affirmed that it was even. Then said they, it is his angel. So she gets in there. And of course, these people that are inside don't believe her. I'm like, Peter's outside. What are you talking about? He's in prison. We know he's in prison because we're praying for him to get out of prison. You know, God's going to get him out of prison, but that's not him. He's not out of prison because we're, you know, you think about it. It doesn't make sense. They should have popped up and said, wait a minute, Peter's outside. God answered our prayer. But they didn't. They were so wrapped up in what they're doing. You know, listen, we do the same thing. I can't tell you how many times I've prayed for something and just forget about it. And then when God answers it, it takes me a little while to remember, hey, wait a minute. You remember you prayed for that a month ago? I mean, that kind of thing happens all the time. I remember when I was in college, I was like, God, I'm going to put you to the test. I want a certain book. And not just any version of this book. I want this certain, not necessarily a certain printing, but I want a certain type of this book. It was a Bible commentary. It's like, I don't want the concise version. I want the full unabridged version. A few weeks later, I was at a Goodwill and I found the concise version of it. And I thought, well, great. God answered my prayer. And the more I thought about it, I was like, wait a minute, God didn't answer my prayer. Well, I was like, okay, well, maybe he did. And, you know, I just, not, you know, he knows best and gave me what I needed. Well, it's very funny though. What did I get for Christmas that year? Just a few months later, I got the unabridged version of that Bible commentary. And it dawns on me, not when I got it, but later on. First, I was like, okay, great. Well, now I've got two of these, you know. But as later on, I realized, like, wait a minute. You prayed for that, and God gave it to you, and you didn't even realize it. You know, we do that stuff. We do that stuff all the time. We get so careful. And I'll tell you something else, another angle you can take with this. We get so busy doing what we think is right and serving God that when God moves, we don't realize it. It's like, I'll tell you a great example of this is with evangelism. We can go out and get so wrapped up in knocking doors and in passing out tracts and doing what we can in spreading the gospel that we focus so much on that we lose sight of the miracle that takes place when somebody gets saved. It's just, boy, it's another notch on your gun, another name in the back of your Bible, another decision card filled out. And we really lose sight of what really happened because we're so focused on we got to knock on more doors. Got to knock on more doors. I've seen people that get so wrapped up in I've got to knock this street tonight that they'll hurry through talking to people and sometimes miss an opportunity to present the gospel just because they're in a hurry because they have to meet a certain quota. And listen, it's not about what we do. It's really about the results. And you know, if we're out going out to spread the gospel, if we get a chance to give it out, forget about those silly little goals. Forget about worrying about knocking the street. Hey, let's make sure this person gets saved. Let's make sure they hear the gospel, that they understand it. And, you know, let's work the person, not just worry about us. Sometimes we focus so much on what we do. We focus so much on, well, I knocked on 50 doors. How many did you knock on? I won 10 souls. How many did you win? And it gets so crazy that we really lose sight of what's about. It's not really about what we do, what we accomplish. It's about what God does. And that's like, just so many times, I think we lose focus on that. We want to build a big bus route. We want to fill a church pew. We want to fill up a church that we neglect what it's all about. And that is reaching the lost. It's about teaching and training these young converts. That's what the Great Commission is not. Hey, you go out and go door to door soul winning. It's not, hey, you go out and run a bus route. It's not, hey, you fit as many people in that church building as you can. The Great Commission is that we are to go out, preach the gospel, that then we are to disciple. That's teach and train young converts. Or actually, number two, when we reach them, number two, we get them in church. And I'm telling you, nowadays, we miss out on that. We're out spreading the gospel, passing out tracts, knocking on doors, and we don't ever really push to get them in church anymore. I'm going to tell you, 50, 60 years ago, that was the big push. It wasn't necessarily let's get the gospel to them. It was, let's get them baptized in church. And that is really why a lot of the fundamentalist churches were growing at such a great rate, was not just because they were reaching people out in the world, but they weren't leaving them out there. They were getting them into the church. We've really lost focus on that because you can produce a lot more numbers, honestly, by skipping that part and just going out and winning them and leaving them in the world. But anyway, the second part is baptizing them in the church, and the third part is teaching and training them, is discipling them. So that is the Great Commission. The Great Commission is not fulfilled because you passed out a tract. The Great Commission is the Great Commission is not fulfilled because you packed out a church building. The Great Commission is fulfilled when you have an impact in someone's life, when you snatch them out of the pits of hell, they become a Christian, and they get in church, and they turn their life around, and you teach and train them how to be a Christian. That is the Great Commission. It just drives me crazy. We get so wrapped up in thinking, well, I have to do this. I have to do that. It's all about what I do. God's going to hate me if I don't do this. You know, listen, God's in for results. And God wants us to be fruitful. God wants us to reach people. But I think God looks down at us thinking, okay, I know you're plenty busy for me, but you're kind of missing the point here. The point is not door knocking. The point is soul winning. Okay? You get the difference in the words there? Door knocking is what we do. Soul winning is what God does. Are we really out to knock on doors? No. I mean, you knock on doors and sell vacuums. That doesn't keep anybody out of hell. But we're supposed to be out spreading the gospel. Boy, I really got off preaching there, and I'm way over time. I apologize for that. That's, you know, the preacher comes out in you every now and then. But that's another application from this story that I take, is these people were so busy doing what a good Christian should be doing that when God really moved, they didn't notice. And we do the same thing. We do the same thing. Boy, where was I at? excuse me. Verse 16. But Peter continued knocking, and when they had opened the door, they saw him. They were astonished. So Peter's still out there banging on the door. Hey, everybody, let me in now. And so they go answer the door, and whoa, Peter's there. They're astonished. Yeah, they're sitting there, you know, their jaw drops, their eyes get big, like, wow, it really is Peter. God really did do something. That shouldn't be a shock. It shouldn't be a shock that God uses you, that God answers your prayer. It shouldn't come as a surprise. It ought to be a way of life. And we ought to be looking for God to move. I tell you what, I think that's something else we lose sight of, is we get so focused on looking at how we look and looking about how much we do that we forget to look for God to move. So verse 7, but he, that's Peter, beckoning unto them with the hand to hold their peace. So he, you know, raises his hand, and I always picture the dramatic Roman style, the Mark Antony or Julius Caesar holding his hand up in front of a group of senators, and friends, Romans, lend me your ears. I don't know why I always picture that, but he raises his hands. Hey, everybody, listen up. It says, declared unto them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, go show these things unto James and to the brethren. And he departed and went into another place. So let's break down. There's quite a bit that happens in here. So he tells a story about what happened. So I'm sure everybody's excited to hear that. And then he says, go show these things unto James and to the brethren. Now, the church at Jerusalem did not have a church building. They would meet in various locations. I mean, it was not really as we would think of a church nowadays. You know, everybody meets in the big auditorium, and everybody that's in there is your church. They did not have that. They were meeting in private homes. They were meeting anywhere they could, you know, out by the river, somewhere. They were just meeting where they could, usually in homes. And I think I can make a case out of the New Testament that was the norm. And that a lot of times you see, like even Paul writing to the house of so-and-so, I think that's talking about a church or a church group that's meeting inside someone's house. Just my opinion. And I think I can make a pretty good case for that. So, but anyway, there's plenty of Christians who were not at John Mark and Mary's house. So what does he do? He's telling them, hey, look, go tell everybody else that I'm out of prison. Get the word around. They don't have to worry about me anymore. And everybody can see that God answered their prayer. And he also says, go tell James. And if you're thinking like you probably are, you think, wait a minute, go tell James. Isn't James dead? Didn't he get killed in verse 2? Okay, yes, James got killed in verse 2, but this is a different James. Just like there's a bunch of different Herods, and we've already talked about that. There's a bunch of different Jameses too. And there's also a bunch of different Marys. I kind of skipped over that, you know, verse 12, but there's quite a few Marys also. But this James is actually, we'll see him written about. Paul writes about him. He's going to pop back up in the book of Acts. In fact, we'll deal with him very shortly here in, I think, about three or four more lessons. But this James was the half-brother of Jesus Christ. So he was a son of Mary and Joseph. He appears to be the pastor of the church, that the apostles themselves were not necessarily the pastor or overseer of the church. They were doing their apostolic work and probably doing a lot of traveling throughout the region by this time because of how the church had spread. So who was actually in charge of the day-to-day operation of the church? I believe it's James, and you make a very good case for this. Paul writes about him in the book of Galatians, describes him as a pillar of the church. So he is very instrumental in the church at Jerusalem, in the early church. And as I just my personal kind of opinion, and I've read quite a few other people that say this, I believe he was the pastor of the church at Jerusalem. So Peter's just saying, hey, make sure you tell everybody and make sure you tell the pastor, make sure you tell the leader, James. And then Peter leaves and goes somewhere else. So he goes into hiding. I just imagine it's like, okay, I've been here. Too many people know. Now I'm going to go hide because the Romans are going to be looking for me very soon. All right, so verse 18, now we're going to see the fallout, at least, you know, on the Roman leadership side. So verse 18, now as soon as it was day, there was no small stir among the soldiers what was become of Peter. So there is pure chaos taking place at the prison. You know, someone checks in, goes back to look for Peter. They knock on the cell door. They unlock it, and Peter's not there. Or perhaps the guys inside woke up, and they look down. The chains are laying there. Peter's gone. They bang on the door like, hey, escape. We've had an escape. I mean, they're searching all throughout the prison. I imagine, you know, they're leaving no stones unturned. They're tearing that place apart. They're interrogating everybody. There's just pure chaos. There's probably a search party going on. They're looking all throughout Jerusalem trying to find Peter because this wasn't supposed to happen. No one is supposed to escape from a Roman prison. And especially this is mysterious because he just basically disappeared as far as the Romans were concerned. You know, it wasn't like there was an attack and, you know, a group of Army Rangers and Green Berets and Delta Force came in and stormed the prison and extracted the prisoner and got him out of there safely. Nothing like that happened. They just looked around. Peter was not there. So it's like, I think chaos ensues. They're tearing the place apart to look for him. So verse 19, and when Herod had sought for him, so here comes Herod. He shows up. They're ready to kill Peter. And found him not. I was like, wait a minute, y'all got Peter? And they said, sorry, sir, Peter's gone. We don't know where he's at. But we're looking for him. We're looking for him. I was like, wait, what in the world? How'd this happen? It says he examined the keepers. So he gets those 16 guys that were in charge of keeping him, calls them on the carpet and says, look, fellas, what happened? They're like, we don't know. He was there. Now he's not. Maybe they said, look, there was a great light. We passed out. We woke up, he was gone. We have no idea what happened. So what happens? And commanded that they should be put to death. Why? Because they had failed their duty. As a Roman soldier, duty was first and foremost. That's sleeping when you were on guard duty was punishable by death because you had not fulfilled your duty. And in this case, they had been given a task. They had failed at it. They had failed at their duty. They were put to death. I mean, this goes all throughout. And you think, okay, well, this is kind of regional troops by this time. But you look back even throughout Roman history, it's a big deal about duty. Armies that lost in battle, it was their duty to go out and defend Rome and conquer. And if they failed, in fact, there's, it says that the women would tell their folks, you know, come back. What's the quote? Something about, you know, come back with your shield or come back on it. You know, so you either come back victoriously or come back dead. But troops that lost in battle, I actually just read a book about the Second Punic War with Hannibal and the Battle of Cannae. That was a pure disaster for the Romans, and the few troops that survived it were exiled. It wasn't, oh boy, hey, we still got some troops. No, they exiled them, wouldn't even let them back into Italy, so, you know, because they had failed at their duty of defeating Hannibal. So, you know, it goes all throughout Roman history. That's not just something new. This isn't something harsh. It is the way Romans work and the way the Roman army works. So these 16 men that were put in charge of keeping Peter, they are killed. And the little final note there in verse 19, and he went down, that's Herod Agrippa, went down from Judea to Caesarea and there abode. So he returns back to the Roman capital. So now we're going to deal very briefly with the death of Herod Agrippa. Now, I'm going to go ahead and say before I get into this, I don't want to ramble because, boy, I'm going way long. I guess the more times I record this, the more I ramble. I don't get more concise. It just it expands more. But the death of Herod, this is another area where some people like to critique the Bible. We have the writings of Josephus. Now, Josephus was a Jewish historian who, well, at this point, it'd be 25 plus years in the future or so, was captured. In fact, I'm actually reading a book about this at this time. He was captured by the Romans during the Jewish revolt and gains the favor of General Vespasian, who becomes Emperor Vespasian, and his family, Titus, and even though he's a captured prisoner, he gains their favor, evidently pretty smooth-talking guy, and he ends up writing quite a bit of history work. He writes a history of the Jewish revolt. He writes a history of the Jews, basically preserving, in a sense, their history and explaining the Jews and their history to the Roman world, which is kind of something nobody had done before. And or maybe he felt like he felt like he was preserving it because, hey, they just got wiped off the field. I mean, slaughtered in battle and were slaves. And but anyway, whatever his motivation was, he wrote quite a bit about this. And he actually does write about the death of Herod Agrippa. And his account varies slightly. Now, in general, it is actually so similar when you read them both, you'll think, okay, a couple of the details aren't the same, but this could be exactly the same story, just told from a different point of view. So I really feel like it is overblown, any criticism that comes of this, you know, the Bible from Josephus. And by the way, Luke was written at least 10, 15 years or so before Josephus. If you want to go with the oldest account, the one closest to the source, it was Luke's writings. Luke actually had contact with a lot of people from the area. Josephus by this time is probably in Rome. He's far away from it. He's working by memory. Maybe he has some other documents and stuff he's going by. But if you want to go to at least the closest historical account, as far as time and probably even distance, you probably have to go with Luke's account. So I would say Luke is more reliable than Josephus. And Luke is actually a very honest historian. Josephus, he's not the most honest source. He's prone to exaggerate his own importance. He's prone to really buttering up the Romans because, hey, they just conquered his people. He is alive pretty much by their grace. And so he makes them sound pretty good, too. And so he's not the most unbiased source. So anyway, I just want to throw that out there because if you study this out, you might run across that. And I just want to throw it out there that I like the Bible account. And besides that, I really don't see that big a difference between the two accounts anyway. But the Bible is true. Listen, I believe the Bible is perfect, that, you know, what God preserved is historically accurate, is spiritually accurate. So I have no reason at all to doubt Luke's account that he wrote in the book of Acts. This is what God wanted preserved, and that is what is preserved. So with that in mind, let's spend a few minutes here. We'll knock this out and finish up this lesson that went way longer than I expected. So verse 20, and Herod was highly displeased with them of Tyre and Sidon. So Tyre and Sidon, those are the cities of ancient Phoenicia. They're, you know, just up the coast from Judea. But they came with one accord, these people of Tyre and Sidon, came with one accord to him, and having made Blastus, the king's chamberlain, their friend. The king's chamberlain would be the guy who's in charge of the king's dwelling place. I mean, this is a very trusted individual. He's an insider, probably has quite a bit of influence with the king. This would be your king's right-hand man, okay? So I've made my friend, said, desired peace. So they've come. They're wanting to get whatever this dispute is about. They want to get it settled and get everything at peace so everybody can keep going on, okay? It says, because their country was nourished by the king's country. So economically or perhaps even physically, maybe they got a lot of grain, but their region depended on the territories ruled over by King Agrippa. And so that could be for grain exports. It could be some economic trade stuff, but this was something for their own good. They had to get settled. So they came down to get it settled. They've bribed or bought off or just influenced the king's chamberlain. So, you know, they have an inside track on getting this solved. So verse 21, upon a set day, arrayed in royal apparel, Herod arrayed in royal apparel, set upon his throne and made an oration unto them. So the day's come for Herod to rule. He is in his court, in this judgment hall. He's dressed in royal apparel of a king, probably, purple garments, some type of crown, the sharpest dressed, best looking guy, you know, probably in the region, because he's got his best suit of clothes on. And so here he is, he's up there and makes an oration of them. So I think he's passing judgment on whatever this case is and making a speech about it, because, you know, that's just kind of what ancient people did. They didn't just say yes or no, let's make a big long speech about it. Or when we write our history, we'll make up a big long speech. That's what the Romans did, you know. They'll make all these dramatic moments where Julius Caesar will crossing the Rubicon will make this huge, you know, 30-minute speech. In reality, he probably just said, okay, boys, let's go, you know. So, but anyway, in this case, Herod actually does. He makes this big, long speech announcing his judgment. That's some of that I'm kind of reading in this. I think that's what's happening. He's passing judgment on whatever this is. It's coming out in favor of the people of Tyre and Sidon. So verse 22, and the people gave a shout, saying, it is the voice of a god and not of a man. So these people are so excited and they're so wanting to butter this guy up that they say, wow, this guy is so amazing. He can't be human. He must be a god. Okay. And now that sounds absolutely ridiculous to us in modern times with our Western mind. But in ancient times, in the Greek-influenced world especially, now Rome, boy, you know, Rome didn't want a king. They didn't like people who started acting too much like a king. They tolerated the emperors, I mean, as long as things were going well. But Mark Antony's downfall, in Roman history was that he started acting a little bit too much like a king and started doing some really weird, wacky stuff and looked like, and, you know, even perhaps some of the stuff with his children, even, you know, proclaiming them to be deities and stuff like that. I mean, but that was the way the kind of the Greek or Eastern part of the Roman world operated. And I say Rome would do some of that later. They would deify dead emperors, but not usually a living one. But they'd also worship their ancestors and stuff anyway, too. So, that really was an outline for the Romans. Okay, boy, all that randomness aside, I'm just trying to say, verse 22, this is really not that crazy for this time period, for this part of the world, for someone to say this. You know, they did. I mean, the Greek war, the Greek, and especially the more eastern part of the world, Persia and stuff like that, they did. They would worship their rulers as gods. And so I'm just saying, it's just not uncommon for that time of the world. The problem is, though it may not be uncommon for them to say this, there was an issue with how Agrippa reacted to it. Because it appears that he didn't try to rebuke him, rebuke them, that this went straight to his head, and he thought, you know, maybe I am somebody. Did he think he was a god? I don't think so. But Agrippa knew enough of the truth. He had enough Jewish background to know that only one person deserved that type of praise, and that was God himself. And that whatever other false religions he may have followed in the Greek / Roman style, all of that aside, he knew enough of the truth that God was going to judge him by the light that he had. And this was the final step. I mean, hey, the guy's already killed James. I mean, we already know that God can't be too favorable to this ruler. But the final straw was, just like with Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel, they got a little bit too puffed up, and God sent judgment on them. So verse 23, and immediately the angel of the Lord smote him because he gave not God the glory. So what was the reason? Because he accepted the glory instead of passing it off, rebuking the people, or turning it back towards God. And it says this was divine judgment. It came from God. It says, and he was eaten of worms. Now that probably of all everything in this story is probably the one everybody's like, what? Eaten of worms? What do you mean by that? Josephus didn't write that. Remember, Luke is a doctor. Luke is probably prescribing diagnosing this in proxy, you know, looking back. Or maybe, you know, this really was what happened. Josephus didn't write it. Josephus writes that, you know, he became sick, and I think it's 5 days later he died. And by the way, and let's say, in the two accounts are more in harmony than a lot of critics want to say, because this does not say that immediately God slapped him down and he died. God, you know, the angel smote him, he becomes sick, and he dies. It does not give any time reference to how long that took place. It just says immediately God smote him. It doesn't say immediately he died. So that's why I think the two accounts are much more in harmony than a lot of critics say. But he's eaten of worms. So some type of infection, you know, that's not uncommon for that type of thing to happen. Even today, you know, these people, especially back then, they're not drinking sanitary water. There's not sanitary conditions for him to have some type of infestation, or I don't know what you'd call it, infestation or whatever, to say that he did not have little creepy crawly things growing inside his belly. That would probably not be that uncommon, okay? So he was eaten of worms and he gave up the ghost. So he expires, he is dead. And on that gruesome note, we end our lesson for today, because, the next couple verses we're going to go on, and we'll use those to set up, Paul's first missionary journey. Though I think we really could, and I'll go ahead and comment on verse 24. What happened? God had judged Herod, who had been persecuting the church. It says, but the word of God grew and multiplied. You know, there's a lot of truth to the fact that, you know, the people who stand against the church of God usually get blown over by God. And, you know, people who work against God, work against his church, usually do not prosper. And they usually do not live long, healthy lives either. They usually have heartache. They usually have turmoil. It's well proven throughout history. Some people take it a little bit too far. J. Frank Norris used to take that a little bit too far, because anybody who criticized First Baptist Church, if you read, you know, some of the books and stuff that they produced, anybody that criticized the First Baptist Church of Fort Worth died violent, mysterious deaths. So not to that extent, Is it true? But it is true throughout the Bible, throughout human history, many, many men who have persecuted God's people, persecuted God's work, have met untimely ends. So that is what happened. You know, Herod met with God's judgment and died. So there we go. And in spite of that, he passes away, he dies. But what happens? Does the church end? No, the church keeps growing. In fact, it's amazing. You would think when the church is persecuted, it would hurt. But usually in times of persecution is when the church grows its best. It has a pure doctrine. It honestly is more evangelistic. And, with all the persecutions, the local persecutions around Judea in the early days, and then later on in the Roman Empire for, a couple of centuries off and on, that the church survived, that it spread, is a miracle and a testament to God's hand upon the church that it kept right on going. So, all right, I'm going to call this an end. I have gone over an hour. I cannot believe I have gone that long. I appreciate you listening today. I hope you've enjoyed it. If this is the first one of these you stumbled across, you can check out BaptistBasics.org for some more resources. This is part of Baptist Basics University. If you click on the BBU tab on the homepage, you can see those. You can check out another podcast I have going, Baptist History Spotlight. You can click on the podcast. And in fact, there's links to the Baptist Basics University stuff on there too. So you can check that out. I got some other stuff if time permits, I really want to kind of pursue also. So maybe in the future there'll be more stuff there. You can subscribe on iTunes, a lot of other stuff. Just check it all out, BaptistBasics.org. If you'd like to email me, I've got a special email account just for the podcast. Just go podcast@BaptistBasics.org, and I will get that. And there's also a link to emails on the website. But anyway, I'd love to hear from you. Hope I've been helping and blessing to you. And I will see you again in the next lesson when we deal with Paul's first missionary journey. Until then, I'm Matthew Gage. Thanks for listening.